This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, the COVID crisis, the COVID pandemic, has intensified over the last week with the emergence of a new variant. The Omicron variant is believed by some to be even more transmissible and virulent than the Delta variant, which we had before. So, for every government in the world, this is another red flag. And it is not just, of course, a public health crisis, although it is very much that. It is also an economic crisis. Businesses are struggling. Workers are losing their jobs. And we have seen nothing like it in our lifetime. And we're very fortunate today to be able to talk to the Minister of Finance, Pascal Donoghue. Pascal is also on our own COVID cabinet subcommittee, and he's the president of the Eurogroup of finance ministers from the Eurozone, which is an elected position, and it speaks of his stature in Europe. Minister, can I begin by asking you about this COVID pandemic? This week, Ursula von der Leyen made a speech in Brussels. She has a medical background. She's the president of the European Commission. She said, we must have a conversation about a vaccine mandate because there's too much community spread. We have to think about it. Angela Merkel made the same point just before she stepped down. Is she right?
So there is already a conversation underway with regard to it. As you'll know, for example, in Austria, they have made the decision that they're aiming to roll out mandatory vaccination across the early part of next year. So that vaccination discussion is well underway. From an Irish point of view, while I always support most discussions opening up, because I do believe we should always guard against assuming there are no alternatives or assuming there are no options to any given course of action, it is something that I would have a really deep and profound reservations about, yes, about whether there's a need for it here in Ireland, because of the progress that we have made on vaccination here in Ireland on a voluntary basis, because we have shown that we have a health and a political and even an institutional culture that on a voluntary basis is able to attain one of the best vaccination levels in Europe. So while I think a discussion is beginning on it, I don't believe that is a discussion that will lead to a course of action here in Ireland that I believe we would want to implement, or indeed that I would want to implement.
Yes, I understand there are civil liberties issues there at the heart of it. Ms. von der Leyen's point was that there 1/3 of the citizens of Europe are not vaccinated. That is 150 million people. I'll get off this subject after I put this point to you. That is 150 million people. And we do seem to understand now, around the world, nobody will be safe unless everybody's safe. If we have 150 million people in Europe unvaccinated, are we going to be able to get a grip on this, the medical and public health element of this crisis?
It does make it more difficult. I remain confident and optimistic that we will get to a far better place next year with regard to containing COVID-19. But you are correct in the premise of your question that with 150 million people who are not vaccinated, with this disease as it stands at the moment, clearly capable of putting many, many, many in hospital, it does make our contest more difficult. But I guess your correct figure of 150 million raises an equally profound issue for me, which is how Europe and indeed a democracy could engage in a compulsory vaccination program of the kind of scale that might be suggested in some countries.
Yes, I mean, Austria, for example, you will have to stay in your house and you'll only be able to visit essential shops.
Yeah, and we've had a team in this vaccination contest and this, in our efforts to beat COVID-19 of what is the balance between individual civil liberty and the common good. And this isn't a debate that is particular to the pandemic, but it's one that has re-emerged very intensely in this pandemic. And even here in Ireland, we've already made choices with regard to this, which subsequently were implemented in other parts of Europe. The very basic example of it being if you don't produce a COVID certificate now, you're not able to enter certain premises and enjoy certain services. So we've already made a stance in relation to where we are on that balance. But as ever in politics, it is a matter of judgment and trying to get to an equilibrium that you believe is right. And in Ireland, given our efforts and our success with voluntary vaccination, I don't believe a vaccination mandate would ever be warranted here in Ireland. And I really hope we never even ever have to get to considering it. But if I look at the challenges that exist in other parts of Europe, mainly those parts of Europe that are a little further to the east, if you look at the issues that tend to lead to vaccine hesitancy in the first place, which is either a distrust in institutions or a distrust in science, I think what we are going to have to do first is when we get to a renewal of our vaccinations, which will happen as life science improves and medical technology catches up with the variant of today. And in particular, when we get to therapies that are better able to deal with the consequences of the disease, not just preventing it. I think at that point, we have to reopen the debate and reopen the case for trying to persuade as many as possible to take the vaccine. And I think that is where we are more likely to make progress in the coming period, because as I said, the practicalities of mandatory vaccination is something that any democracy will have to consider really, really carefully. And maybe what might happen instead is to balance the trade-off between your civil liberties and the common good of higher levels of vaccination. Maybe that might tilt a little bit more and more in the favour of vaccination efforts before we get to the point of a vaccine mandate.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, now the economic consequences are severe, as we all know in this country and as people know in Europe. And you're at the very heart of this. You're on the cabinet COVID subcommittee, which makes not just public health decisions, but also as president of the Euro Group, which is the Euro zone finance ministers. You will be aware of the concerns of the European Central Bank. Inflation in November in Europe was 4.9%. And you'll also be aware, of course, that last week, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve in the United States, he said he had coined the phrase transitory inflation. And at a Senate hearing last week, he told the Senate Banking Committee, we can retire the word transitory. So they are also very worried. How worried are you, because you're in the front line as a Minister of Finance here, how sustainable is the supports that you are rightly giving to businesses, to workers made unemployed in hospitality, in travel, in retail? How sustainable, if, for example, this Omicron variant proves in a poor scenario to be very virulent, how sustainable are your efforts to support the people of this country?
So they are sustainable, and we can sustain them while we are battling the disease. And they are sustainable because of the actions of the European Central Bank, and they are sustainable because of the level of employment that we have in Ireland that makes such a difference to the level of tax we collect. And also, and this was a long battle and a difficult one, Ireland has restored a reputation for being creditworthy. We went into this economic pandemic with our public finances perceived by the financial markets to be in a very safe and very resilient place. So for those three reasons, we are able to sustain support and intervention to help deal with the economic consequences of the disease. But in completing my answer, I'd end with two points. The first one is that just because we can't sustain it for now doesn't mean we can sustain it forever. And we will get to a point that I hope and expect will be enabled by an improvement in our health, in which we will have to make choices about what we continue. And secondly, just because we are able to sustain it for now doesn't mean we can sustain it at this level for all in the economy. Because as your programme has discussed at other points, the multi-speed economy that we do have within Ireland does mean now that different parts of our economy are really recovering at different paces. So we've 2.4 million people at work in Ireland. That's more than we had before the pandemic. So on a macro level, that's a very, very positive position.
Yes.
And I remember being on your programme over a year and a quarter ago. And as optimistic as I am, if you'd said to me that we would be at 2.4 million people now, I would have thought that would have been a hell of an achievement for us all to deliver. But underneath that 2.4 million figure is the fact that by sector, it's really different. And we have to look at how we can, if we, and how we can intervene in different sectors to help them back to a better place. But we will get to a point, maybe even, and I'm hoping and aiming for it to be across next year, that the huge levels of support that we have in our economy, we have to bring to an end. But this will have to be, I hope, when we've got to a better place with COVID-19.
And that brings us round
to where we began.
To where we began. And I don't want to labour the point, and I won't. But at some point, the responsibility people have for their own, to their own community, and for the well-being of their own community and indeed the country, they should do the responsible thing. And that is the case, isn't it? That we do face the consequences of our own inaction or our own silliness.
Yeah, when we've had this discussion before, we've talked about it on a global level. We've talked about it that nobody is safe until everybody is safe.
Yes.
And actually, this is a debate that we've primarily thought about in terms of a responsibility to the developing world. And we've had and made progress in terms of the export of vaccines to there. But underneath the average figure of the high level of vaccination that Europe does have is the reality, and it's really difficult for those countries, that you've a number of countries that are very significantly below that average level.
Yes.
And due to this, this creates really big risks for them and also risks for the rest of us. So being vaccinated, getting the vaccine, and in particular to bring it all to life, getting your booster vaccination when it's offered to you is a profound act not only of personal responsibility, but it's a profound act of care to those you love or those who are near you. And on those two pillars, I'd be making the case to all of your listeners that particularly if they're offered the booster vaccine, to please take it. That if maybe concerns about their own health aren't sufficient, because they, you know, may think they're healthy, they may be young and so on, though we know none of those things are a barrier to COVID. You just run the risk of your body and your health being a cipher to passing the COVID onto somebody else.
Yes.
And we are also aware, particularly when we think about our elderly or people who may have underlying health conditions. I know in the darkest days of the pandemic, what worried me more than myself getting sick is that I'd make somebody else sick.
Yes.
And they might be able to cope with it in the way I might. And we are back to that point, and we need to make that case again.
Right. In a European context as well, let me ask you about the importance of the United States and their economy and indeed their inflation to the rest of us. Now, 4.9 is the figure for Europe in November. Those of us who are old enough to remember inflation and the accompanying interest rates would be worried now. And I'm sure the Germans, for example, are worried. They have their own historical reasons to be worried. Is the United States very central to the European economy and the world economy?
Yes, it is. And the success of an American recovery is a vital component to our ability to recover here in Ireland and in Europe. And in terms of the impact that they can have in what happens with inflation, you really have touched on it in your question, that American levels of inflation have a significant effect on what can happen with global inflation and indeed how they can export inflation to those countries who do trade with them. So for all of those reasons, the economics of America and the politics of America have such an impact on all of us. But all that being said, if you look at the success of the American economic recovery, if you look at where they are now with growth, if you look at what is happening with jobs recovery and the number of people now at work in America, while they do have other labour market issues that we don't have here in Europe, on a very macro level, there are really clear signs and huge evidence of an American recovery that is underway that in turn has helped Europe and the rest of the world to grow. We do have an issue that you might be able to explore, that you might explore with me now in the next few questions about what is happening with inflation and the outlook for that. But I'd very quickly say before we go on to it, that if you look at the last time we had inflation levels that you touched on again, they were accompanied by really high interest rates. How central banks intervene in economies is now fundamentally different to how it would have been at that point, particularly in the 1970s. where they now use a whole array of new policies that tend to be referred to as unconventional monetary policies, how they intervene with bond markets, for example. And they're the kind of things that over time, maybe the Fed and maybe the ECB will look at, that could be a response back to what is happening with inflation. And the standard interest rate response, while it may well happen if the central banks do decide it to happen, may be very different to where we would have been when we had high inflation before, particularly in the 70s.
Let me ask you about our own people, the businesses, the workers, the areas of hospitality, non-essential retail, travel, and all of the people now being, in some cases, terminally damaged, their businesses, by this pandemic. You're at the heart of it in both your role as Minister for Finance and also on the Cabinet COVID Subcommittee. There have been tensions between NEFID and the government, really, but don't want to make too much of them. Would it be fair to say there's too much blather and idle talk, which doesn't help anybody, about the solution and the kind of leadership you need at this time in a crisis like this is strong rather than weak? Do you get my meaning?
I sure do.
You're laughing.
I sure do. Well, I am, you and I can see each other as we're having this interview, yeah. And I'm aware that given my political beliefs, the last thing I'm going to be doing is making the case for the kind of strong man theory of the leadership of politics. And I don't think either of us are advocating that. What I do think the qualities that I certainly am aware of from a political point of view when we're trying to deal with the terribly difficult situation that we're in is, I think, firstly, you have to be honest about uncertainty. You really do have to be candid in being clear about what you know, but equally acknowledging that there is much that there is difficult to know because of how dynamic the disease is and our health environment is. Secondly, I think it's really important to be hopeful and positive on the basis of fact. And I believe there is ample evidence, even at the moment, to show our ability to make progress. And then thirdly and finally, I also think it's very important to be pointing to what we have all achieved collectively.
Yes.
Because it is, you know, media and debate and opposition politics understandably focus in on where things go wrong. And I'm deeply aware of where things have gone wrong and why and decisions I've made, you know, always aware of that. But at moments of such strain as we're facing at the moment and brittleness and fatigue, there is value in continuing to make the case for what we have achieved collectively.
Yes.
Because we have achieved much. So maybe rather than a version of strength that is based on a certainty which isn't to be found in a situation that is as fast moving as this.
Yes.
Or a tone of certainty that decouples, for example, from science.
Yes.
Maybe trying to have some authority based on the different qualities that I've talked about is certainly what matters to me and what you try, how you try to convey what you're doing and why. But it's a tall order to tell the truth, Eamon.
Yes.
And you'll be the first to tell me that the qualities I've outlined are ones that aren't always delivered, which I accept.
There is some speculation now among epidemiologists who are the principals in this in terms of analysis that this crisis could last for another 2 to 3 years because of the variants and because of the lack of vaccines in the poorer parts of the world. How sustainable, for how long can we sustain the present situation? And oughtn't we, and by we I mean Europe, because America has contributed more to the poorer countries in terms of vaccines than the rest of the world put together. Shouldn't that be a high priority for wealthy countries such as our own and such as the European Union, because until we get the whole world as vaccinated as we can, this is likely to continue as we are at the moment, lurching from crisis to crisis.
And the short answer to your question is that for 2022, our global responsibilities will be even more preeminent than they have been this year. And what I expect to see happen next year, and it will happen, is I think Europe is going to become the largest net exporter of vaccines to the people that you've just referred to, because we'll have the capacity to do it and the science to do it. And we have the level of economic wealth to do it. So we should do it, and we will. And then as we are doing it, we then need to continue with our efforts to support the economies who are exceptionally vulnerable in developing economies, in developing parts of the world, through institutions like the IMF. So that responsibility that we have, and if you don't accept my argument on the basis of morality, if somebody didn't accept my argument on the basis of morality, there is an economic self-interest to that argument that alone yes. means we should do it. So yes, we're doing some of it. We need to do more of it. And if you look at what kind of world we want and where we want to be in 50 years' time or 100 years' time, I believe Europe, despite its many difficulties and challenges, and despite the disappointments that many citizens have, either in our national or our European efforts, I still believe is rare in the focus that we put on values and the awareness that we have in trying to help each other and pool our efforts to avoid conflict and to make progress on really difficult things together. And if you accept that that is something really precious, and I do, that you should make the case for, and I do too, you also, then the next step in that is saying, well, what can we do to help others? And we will have to do that, Eamon. You raise a prospect that we might discuss for a moment, which is what does this look like if it goes on for many years?
Yes.
But if we've time to do that, we can.
Yes. Well,
I'll say a word about that too.
Yeah. There is a prospect as we observe what's happening at the moment. In the UK, for example, a total mess. And almost everywhere in Europe, Belgium, there have been riots, Germany, no government has got this right. And you could argue that our government has got it right more often than most. The point does seem to be, though, that public health experts, epidemiologists, are telling us that this could go on. One estimate from a guy called Ferguson, who is renowned in Britain,
yep.
He was the top epidemiologist there, estimates it could go on for another 4 years. Now, as somebody who holds the nation's purse, and I'm sure it's the last thing you think about before you lay your head down at night, how sustainable would that kind of scenario be for the world? Never mind Ireland.
So all of this and what it means for the people that I serve and try and play a role in leading in government is the last thing I think of at night and the first thing in the morning. Not just the economic effects of what you are talking about, but clearly the health
yes.
and the mental health effects of all of this make that as demanding a prospect as you could imagine. So I'd say maybe if I can, two quick things in response to a gigantic question. The first thing is that while it is unfortunately feasible, but still difficult for us to acknowledge, COVID-19 could be with us for some time to come. However, that's not the same as it automatically being a global pandemic or a national
yes,
pandemic.
It can become endemic
for the same period.
And we could have a boost or a shot every year.
That is exactly yeah. it. It could well become a disease that is still dangerous, still very difficult, but due to the progress that I really believe we will make again, from a life science and medical technology point of view, we break the link between this disease existing and it automatically being a pandemic with yes. all of the consequences you've just talked about. And then if I deal with the economic question that you've put to me, were we to be in those kind of circumstances? One of the things I really learned from the era of COVID so far, from an economic point of view, is simply the extraordinary resilience and entrepreneurship and flexibility of both our economy and indeed the developed economy across the world.
Yes.
And to give a very small example of it, if 3 years ago you and I had said that we would decouple going into the office from the ability of an economy to grow.
Yes.
It would have looked just an extraordinary thing to make happen, but that has happened.
Yes.
And what I believe the role of governments would then become is if we were in that kind of environment, what are the kind of policy decision and supports that we would have to put in place to facilitate that kind of transition and that kind of change? But all that being said, while of course this is something I consider, I still do believe for next year we're going to make another big step forward. But I do believe we're on the early phases of huge change in democracies and in societies.
Yes.
And if you look at where we are with Storm Barra, if you look at where we are with COVID, these are all reminders of how nature changes, how it's engaging with our lives. And that combined with all the changes that are happening in technology and with this pandemic indicate to me that this is a big period of change in our future.
Indeed.
Which is why I go back to Europe, go back to the European Union, and go back to the value of centrist politics in democracies for helping us navigate our way through, and the day of it being a storm, to navigate our way through those kind of storms.
Okay, Minister for Finance, Pascal Donoghue, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Stand. We're very grateful, and good luck with your difficult work for the foreseeable future. We're very grateful to Minister Donoghue, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.